Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 23rd, 2003. Today's session is entitled For the Healing of the World, the ELCA in Senegal, Session 1 of Out of West Africa, presented by Anne and Willie Longji, number LAA 2003-01. Let's listen in.
Has everybody figured out what that's code for already?
Yeah.
Is it really Bob?
Yeah, it's really Bob. We are Anne and Willie Longji, and we're real pleased to be in this part of Washington, the state of Washington, in this great community, and to be sharing some time with you. Many of you are on vacation, some of you are here working and giving of your gifts and your talents. So it's really exciting to be a part of this community, even if it is for too short of time. I think you probably, most of you read the little bio on us, which gives the nuts and bolts about who Willie and I are, or what we've done at least. Maybe Willie can tell a little bit more about himself and where he comes from, and I will too.
Pardon?
Jantan?
Until?
Mauru?
What?
Nobody answered.
Nobody answered.
Except me.
And yeah, actually. Good evening and thank you very much. I was just saying, how are you guys doing?
And I answered, we're all at peace. So is that an okay answer for all of us today?
Yes.
All right.
So that was just one of the many languages in which God's message is being spread around the world. And it is the Pula language. The Pula is a language spoken by the Fulani people of Senegal. But I'm not Fulani. I am Noni from Cameroon. I was born in the English-speaking part of Cameroon. Cameroon is bilingual like Senegal.
Like Canada.
Like Canada, excuse me. I'm very used to Senegal now, I think. So Cameroon is bilingual like Canada, English and French. And I happen to be born in the English part of Cameroon, the English-speaking part of Cameroon. But I have my mother language, which is Noni, and my people are called the Noni people. So the same like the language. And I learned English when I went to school in Cameroon. Also French I learned when I went to school. And I did all of my schooling in Cameroon, and when I was done, I started working in community development, just organizing community groups, and helping figure out how we could solve some of the common problems in each of the communities where we worked. And I did a lot of this work in the part of Cameroon, in a town in Cameroon that is called Ngaoundéré. This is where the Lutheran Church is based in Cameroon. And during one of these, during my work, there was a training session in Yaoundé, which is the capital of Cameroon, on extension work techniques. So I traveled from Ngaoundéré to Yaoundé, and that's where I met Anne, who came from the Central African Republic with some of her colleagues who were working with the church in the Central African Republic. And that's how we met.
So he gave you a little more history than I thought he'd give you. And I'm basically a North Dakota girl who has visited Holden as a kid but hadn't been back as an adult, so this is a new experience for me. I have been living on the African continent for about 8 years now. Is that right? Yeah, it must be about 8 years. I had actually originally studied in Senegal for a year as a Rotary Scholar. My junior year abroad was in Senegal, but never thought that we would end up back there again. So it's been pretty exciting, though, to be there the past 2.5 years. So where is Senegal? Who can describe where this country is found? Somebody?
West Africa.
How far west? Because in fact, West Africa sometimes is apart from Cameroon, which is what he calls the armpit of Africa, you know, the little bend there, all the way over to the western coast. So it is, it's the furthest western country. And in fact, Dakar, the capital city, is on a peninsula that juts out into the Atlantic. And the furthest western point on the continent is sort of in the, within the city limits of Dakar. You can't really go there because it's a Club Med, and you can only go to Club Med if you're on a Club Med tour. But anyway, you know, we still claim that we've been to the furthest western point. But we are not living on that coastal area, but we actually live quite a bit inland from the coast, about 3 hours by car, about 6 hours from the capital city. And the part of Senegal that we're in is considered the Sahel. So it's the geographic region that's just south of the Sahara. So we're taking dry and hot. In Dakar, when we're in the capital city, and we have to go there for meetings and stuff, and most of the other ELCA missionaries are based in Dakar in the urban areas just outside of the capital. When we're there, people say, where do you live? Where are you from? And we say, we're from Linguère. And their jaw drops. And they say, oh, it's hot there. Or else they say, their jaw doesn't drop, and they say, there's lots of milk there. So those are the two known qualities of our town by the general Senegalese public who don't live there. Sort of like how when I moved out to Washington, D.C. to go to university, people's jaw dropped when I told them I was from North Dakota. They didn't know people lived there. our ELCA missionaries, Senegal is one of the exceptions of the way that the ELCA and the Division for Global Mission work. The way to explain that best, I think, is to say that there is not a relationship with a partner local Lutheran church in Senegal, which means that the ELCA, in sending missionaries to Senegal, is determining what kind of people and to do what kind of things they're sending people there, instead of responding to what the local Lutheran church is requesting of the ELCA as a partner. That might be changing pretty soon because the Holy Spirit works in ways nobody really knows, and there is a small Christian community, 3 worshiping congregations with whom the Lutheran missionaries, some of the pastors, are working. And those 3 communities are discussing and writing a constitution to become a Lutheran church. And then it most likely the ELCA would be in direct partnership with that group. And eventually it would change our way of working and being in that place. So that's exciting. It's challenging. I know some of you do have experience overseas working with, and especially traveling and working in other parts of the world with our sisters and brothers in different churches. It's not going to be easy, but it's still really exciting as we imagine the changes ahead. So, you want to tell? Yeah, sure. Go for it.
Okay. The work of the ELCA started back in Senegal in the 70s.
It wasn't the ELCA, though. I always have to get them up to.
I'm applying the name today.
Yeah, that's
so
okay.
You sort of forget what went by yesterday. So this work started in Senegal in the 70s, and the work can be divided into 2 major areas. One of the areas is the spiritual work, which we where there's a leadership building, trying to evangelize, it's been called that in the common language, trying to evangelize and bring the word to the people who have not yet known the word. And then the other word part is development, which means responding to the needs of the people. And when this work started in Senegal, I don't know if the missionaries who went there at that time actually thought that someday there will be a church. But I think that as people who have confidence in the Holy Spirit and confidence in our Lord Jesus Christ, they had at the back of their head that the Holy Spirit will be there someday. So we're seeing the fruits now. So, and the people who we went there to work with were people of the ethnic group called the Fulani group, which I just mentioned earlier. And this is a very big ethnic group, which goes all the way from Cameroon and the Central African Republic to Senegal. So this area covers over 12 countries along the western coast of Africa. And this group is around, it's numbered between 15 and 20 million people. And they are a nomadic people. They are herders. So their livelihood is based around animals. And they have cows, goats, sheep, horses, donkeys, sometimes. So these people are traditionally Muslim. They believe to be Muslim people, even from birth. Although you still find among these people who don't know very much about Islam. But when you talk of Fulani person, the first thing people think about is Islam. So I think it is for this reason that the church at that time decided that it would be a good idea to bring the word to these people. And that is probably one of the reasons that the church went to work there. Then the town where we live in Senegal is called Linguère. It is to the north central part of Senegal. And here there is a mixture of Wolof and the Pula, or Fulani people, about 50-50. Wolof is one of the ethnic groups in Senegal, and it is the biggest ethnic group in Senegal. So the language of these people, which is called Wolof, has become the national language in about almost 100% of Senegalese will speak Wolof. That is expected, that 100% of Senegalese will speak Wolof before they learn the French and the English. And Senegal, as you know, was a French colony. It was colonized by the French. And so the official language used in administration in schools is French. So besides the language that a child will be born to speak, which is not necessarily Wolof, like for example, a Pula child will have to speak Pula at home. Then when they go out to the streets, they will learn Wolof. And then if they go to school, they will learn French. So, and maybe eventually learn other languages. And the work that the ESCL does in Senegal is in two areas. There's one of the work is done in Dakar, which is the capital city, and actually precisely on the outskirts of Dakar in a neighborhood called Yombo, which is one of the very poor neighborhoods of Dakar. And the missionaries who started work here actually went to this area when it was still very, very remote, and they had no electricity, no running water, and even no roads going to this place. But now this area is, the people in this place they really appreciate the presence of the missionaries there and the work they have done so far. And here we have a cultural center, which is a youth center responding to educational resources. Educational needs. So it's an educational resource center with a library, computer lab, sporting facilities, recreational facilities, and sewing programs for women. Then in this area too, with the missionary pastors who are there, are working with two worshiping communities, which have, one of them is Pula speaking, and it has come out of the Pula community. So these are people who have been touched by the word, and they have decided to become Christians. So this is there's one smaller community in this area. Then, besides this one, there is a French-speaking community, which is made up of mainly of an ethnic group that is called the Jola. And these are people, most of them have moved from the southern part of Senegal where Christianity was before, and are now settled in this area. So we have two worshiping communities in that area with which the mission works. When you go back to Lingue now where we are, we have also a worshiping community which is based, some of them are inside Lingue, the town, and some are outside in the villages. And this community has been also as a result of our work in that area. So our pastor colleagues who are in Dakar will come up to Lingue and work with this group. And we, from time to time, will worship with them too. And besides that, I work with the youth resource center, like the cultural center in Dakar, which is a little smaller than the one in Dakar because of our population too. And it has the same facilities. It has the library, a computer lab, a sporting and recreational facilities, and a sewing program. Besides that, I work with a herders cooperative, which was also helped, which was born out of the work of the mission with the Pula community. So it is mainly Pula herders who have formed this cooperative, and it groups about 4,000 plus people, working in over 40 villages. And it provides animal health services to the members and to the community. It helps out in the dry season when there is no pasture. We have a dry season of 8 months, and everything dries up completely, so that it is very difficult to feed the animals. And this is something that is very, the animals are so important to the lives of these people, that if you have to talk to them, it is important to go through their animals. So in the dry season, we try to stock feed, which we then resell back to, we resell to the members at affordable rates. Then the women, according to Pula tradition, are in charge of the milk. The men are in charge of the cows, and the women are in charge of the milk. So the women milk the cows, they sell the milk, and that's how they make their income. And the milk, the men sell the animals, and they have the money. And they can choose to share with the family or not. But that was a joke. they are responsible men, so.
They are men.
So what we've been doing with the women is that we, because of this harsh climate, when the cows are milked, the milk will start to ferment in about 2 or 3 hours after milking. And in the villages, you don't have power, you don't have refrigerators, no cooling system. So we try to collect this milk, and process it, pasteurize it, and process it into a yogurt drink, which can keep for up to 24 days under refrigerated conditions. And then we sell this. So this helps the women to make more money from their milk. And then Anne works in the, what?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard him talk that much all at once.
I'm so excited.
That was pretty good. Could you understand him? Sure. I told him sometimes he needs to take it off because it's like a slip. Do you want to keep wearing it or do you want to take it off though?
I think I look cool like this.
Thank you. code for him.
Yeah.
All right, as long as you can understand.
I thought maybe he had mumps.
Or a bad toothache. Yeah, so Willie really gave you quite a lot of information there. You're just being bombarded here. But we're not going to talk too much longer, and then we just want to be able to talk with you and hear how you react to some of what we've been talking about. I think a couple things that we forgot to say in the general presentation. Senegal probably is close to 10 million people. There are 10 million people maybe. Well, there are probably 9 million people in Senegal. Willie, let's wait with that.
Wait?
Yeah,
okay.
Until we get to the question. But you can sit down.
All right.
Probably a million Senegalese are actually overseas as migrant workers. And that the majority of those being in Europe, France, Italy, Spain, as well as other parts of West Africa, the Ivory Coast, Gabon, you know, all over the place, and then also in the United States. So that's a huge number of Senegalese overseas, just a tenth of the population, they imagine. So now, about 3 million of those who are in Senegal live in Dakar, or in the urban area just outside of the capital city of Dakar. And the rest then are in the countryside and are mainly farmers or cattle people. In our area, that's pretty much it. In some other areas of the country, there's industry and phosphate mining, and tourism has become a really big thing, for better or for worse. Particularly for Europeans coming down to sit on nice beaches, which are very nice. So, no doubt why that came about. It is a country which is 95% or so Muslim, and who knows what the percent, the Christian population is somewhere between 1 and 4. We see different stats in everything we look at, so but that gives you a general idea. And most of that Christian population is Catholic from the time of the French colonial presence and with Catholic missionaries at that time, which means it's also in certain geographical areas of the country, not where we are. So the church began to work in an area which was 100% Muslim. Besides the few civil servants, Senegalese civil servants who had come from those other regions where there are Catholic populations who are living and working in our community. So now to get back to what I do, since he gave a bit of an explanation about his work, I'm involved in community health work. I follow a ELC missionary who was a nurse midwife, and she was very, successful sounds too glitzy or something. She was very effective in the work that she did. She gave all of herself for the work that she did, and that was basically in working in the small villages outside of our town to provide access to basic health care. She worked with the communities to determine whether they were ready to run and manage a community health clinic, which we call by the name of Health Huts. And it is an actual hut, but the essential part are the people who work there. A community health worker, a traditional birth attendant, were trained to work in the village, mainly well, their important role is to provide basic care, to administer medicines for basic illnesses, the most probably important being malaria, being able to refer people to higher levels of care. The birth attendant, of course, attending births and helping pregnant women and new moms, which you can just imagine. A lot of that work in most cases when you hear of health huts being started, you hear of an incredible rate of failure, just because all of the legwork of getting the community mobilized often tends to be neglected. In the case of the work that she did, she had 9 health huts going, and 10 years later, 8 of them are still running and running well. So that's an incredibly good rate. Our role continues to be, and my role in particular, continues to be support to the communities in how do we continue to manage these. And also we run a depot with medicines because the state systems haven't been able to ensure a continuous supply of meds. We get our meds the same place as the state hospital, but they just don't manage it as well. So they'll run out of chloroquine, which is the basic medicine for treating malaria, and we'll still have supplies of chloroquine. So it's still, that's one of my goals is to see our depot, our medicine depot, shut down. And that means that the state hospitals is running and we don't need to provide that service anymore. In fact, providing it, we've helped out the state health structures just as much as the health huts that we've traditionally worked with. So the medical supervision, I'm not medically trained, the medical supervision of the health huts is carried out by the state health structures. They also try to have a nurse and a highly trained midwife get to those health huts at least once a month for well woman and well baby care, vaccinations, family planning, etc., etc. So that's a snapshot of that work. I work very closely with a Senegalese woman who is taking on more and more responsibility in that work. We have gotten a lot more work because one of the joys of doing this kind of work is that other people don't do it the same way. USAID, our great, good old government-supported agency for international development, came in and built 30 health huts but didn't do any community mobilization, so that most of those structures aren't functioning, except in the villages where we already were helping village pharmacies to run. So the hospital, the state health folks have turned around and asked us to try to bring the donkey back in front of the cart and get those health huts running as well. So whereas she's taking on a lot of responsibility, we just got a lot bigger workload too. As she takes on more responsibility, I'm really trying to move and work with the head doctor, so the head social worker, and some other people in our community to respond more to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. A lot has been done in Senegal, supposedly, which is one of the reasons why the rate is relatively low in Senegal compared to other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. But I don't see much going on in the rural areas, and I really don't want to see the same situation in Senegal as we are seeing in other parts of Africa. So we need to make a concerted effort now in health education, in access to testing, in care provided to those who are living with HIV/AIDS. So we're really getting started with doing some of that in our rural community. So just to add on to that quickly, for those of you who are ELCA folks or Missouri Synod too, the Stand With Africa campaign is one of the ways I've gotten funding for already for some of the HIV/AIDS work. Otherwise, the community health and the animal health projects are supported with World Hunger Funds. The cultural center or youth center that he described, both the one in our community and the one in the capital city, are just Division for Global Mission budgeted activities. So that just gives you a picture. And we have put out a few brochures here around the front, so people are interested in some of those things. But we're sort of low-tech, high-tech people. somebody gave us a digital camera. We learned how to take pictures with it. We learned how to put them on our computer. We learned how to plug it into a projector, but we're not PowerPoint people, so you're going to get some pictures now as we just discuss, and we want you to say what comes out of your anger or your joy or whatever might be there at this point.
Yeah, so I think with this snapshot, we would like to, we don't want it to be a teacher-student kind of thing, so we should, we will be open to any discussions, to any advice, to any questions, and any opinions that you have. Share your experiences, ask any questions. Every question is very important. We've had situations where... Yeah.
Was that first piece glasswork from Senegal?
No, it's a
batik.
Batik, okay, thank you.
Yeah, I like this one. Might even be the same artist.
Yeah. It's one of the very common art work in Senegal. People do a lot of this.
I'd be interested to know how well the acceptance is for family planning in the Muslim population.
Yeah, you know, Senegal has its own form of Islam. And we're not going to get too deep into that because we're not experts. I guess what I see in the villages in which we work, family planning has been grasped onto, and that there has not been much rejection of it. And I think to the point where even the religious leaders and the community leaders, who are men in most, almost every case, are supportive of it. I mean, there might be still a few holdouts, but I think in general, it has not been as challenging to get it accepted. Maybe a lot of that is because of the focus that Sushi, the nurse that I followed, put on working with women. And she was exclusively, I mean, she didn't even consult men. So she really...
Are the men comfortable with having a nurse or a female health care person take care of them?
Well, see, she didn't. She refused pretty much to consult the men. And so it was the village health workers. If she, because she did provide curative care while she was still there. And if she was in a health hut, well, she wouldn't refuse if somebody was in a really dire situation, but she would pretty much refer them to the health worker, and maybe she would give pointers to the health worker, who in all of these villages is a man. And all of the traditional birth attendants are women, except one where the village health worker doubles as a man. It doubles as the midwife, as the birth attendant.
And that's one of the exceptional cases, because it is pretty difficult for a man to be a midwife within that community. So that's one of the exceptions.
But he's so highly respected that it's worked almost. He says... The only women who are really ashamed to come to him or to call him for deliveries are like his own sisters. But otherwise, there, and he says there are a few others, but generally it's really quite amazing. Yeah.
What kind of government? I mean, the Muslims must not control the government.
No, it is, it's a secular state. It's not an Islamic republic.
French.
Yeah, and...
They have an elected president, an elected parliament, with many political parties.
Yeah. It's interesting that so many of the people, so much of the population is Muslim.
Senegal is known traditionally as the place where Islam came into Black Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, from North Africa, and then came in through the northern, just through Mauritania, and then into Senegal. So it is in the 11th or 12th centuries.
Is it a stable government?
Right now it is really stable. So, yeah.
How are you accepted as a woman from the United States?
I don't even think about it very much. So maybe that tells you that I don't... I think maybe the one obstacle for people is that I'm young. And it doesn't matter necessarily if I'm American or whatever. It's just that I'm young and I seem younger than I am even. But otherwise, I think I'm really well received. The Senegalese are very welcoming and open. Although Willie oftentimes tells a story, I don't know if I can tell it as well, or just this idea that when you arrive in Senegal, particularly when we came and people knew that we were going to be there a while, they say to us, welcome, we're glad you're here, we hope that you like us, we hope you like our food, we hope you like our country, and have a nice stay until you go back. So there's an assumption that you are always more tied, I think my reading of it is that you are always from your home, and you cannot necessarily become part of another place, but you're welcome while you're there.
Why do these people have white on their face?
Oh, that's just it's a holiday. In fact, I don't know what's it called in, it's like New Year's, Muslim New Year's, what is that called maybe in Arabic? I don't know. In Senegal, they call it Tamharit, and kids go around in the evenings, behave sort of like Halloween, and they get dressed up. Oftentimes girls wear boys' clothes, boys wear girls' clothes, and they go around banging on little drums or pots or something, and you give them a treat. So, or either a coin or a cookie or a piece of candy or something.
You know what the birth rate is and the infant mortality?
No. I don't. I have the stats somewhere, but that kind of stuff doesn't stand my head.
In terms of age and the feeling of hopelessness that a lot of people in medicine have to do with sexual habits in Africa, what's the general level of understanding, say, among, say, the city people about how AIDS is spread and how frightened are they about all this? I mean, what's happening with education and how's that all going?
I don't think they're very frightened. And I think the government has been shooting itself in the foot the last year or 2 years by bragging about how low their rates are. And so basically they're sending out this message that, well, if we've been telling you there's a risk, there isn't a risk because we have such a low percentage. I really don't see much of a fear.
Yeah, there's not very much of a fear. Maybe that's one of the reasons. But it is common to see a young man or a young woman in Senegal who doesn't know anything about it, mm-hmm. who has never heard anything about it. Which means that there's a lot of work to be done in that area. So it doesn't really necessarily mean they reject it, but it's difficult to know, to have somebody's opinion on something they don't know. You know.
How large is the ELCA presence in Senegal?
We're the ELCA presence in Linguère. We have a couple working in administration based in this area just outside of the capital. We have another pastor working at the cultural center, the director of the cultural center there. John Spaulding is a pastor working with the Fular-speaking Christian community. And Viking Dietrich does literature development, especially national languages. And that's everything from publishing national authors to creating Christian education materials in Pular. And then we also now, the Division for Global Mission has sort of restructured in the last couple of years, and we have a regional rep for West Africa, and he's based in Dakar. That travels throughout West Africa. Who is that? Cliff Nelson? Could be.
Lewis.
Cliff Lewis Sorry, don't know where
so
that came from.
We're talking about six units.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what we call units.
Units, these are families.
A unit is a couple or one?
It's a family.
We're
or
a
one.
Unit.
Yeah.
One.
From
yeah.
one to a big family.
What is the literacy rate and how many children go to school and what level do they go? Boys and girls.
Here again, I don't have the percentages in my head, but Senegal is not, though, at least in West Africa, there's this impression that Senegal is this highly educated, people are highly educated, because there's this there's a group, a percentage of elites who are highly educated and have gone on to important leadership positions internationally. But in fact, Senegal has not been very successful in their literacy work nor in their formal education work. Especially, we always make the comparison to Cameroon, and that's not really fair because Cameroon's sort of on the other end. They did a really good job, it seems. There's a move right now to get everybody into school by the year 2015. And you see construction projects everywhere. The government, the Ministry of Education is building classrooms in the smallest of villages to try to get all the kids into school. And at the same time, they're trying to find enough teachers to be able to teach all those kids. So they're doing programs of taking like 10th grade graduates and giving them 2 or 3 months of training and sending them out into these communities to be teachers. So it looks like they're looking for getting everybody in the classroom and then hopefully afterwards they'll work on the quality. But the actual literacy rate is relatively low. So there, at the same time, Senegal has just been bombarded with NGOs, non-governmental organizations who are trying to run different kinds of literacy programs, some of which have been successful, but we're talking about huge numbers of people who've never set foot in a classroom or been in a learning environment to become literate in their own language.
Does Senegal have the custom of the circumcision of women there?
In some areas, yeah. It's not across the whole population, nor is it throughout all of the ethnic groups. But even among the Pular, there are certain regions in the country supposedly where it's practiced, and there are others where it's not. There again, there are a lot of non-governmental organizations who, Senegalese and international, who have come to try to work to fight that practice. And I think in some places they've been successful, but it's not the kind of thing you can do just overnight. So. Yeah.
So many African nations had highly developed civilizations before the European colonization, and before the slave trade. What's the history of Senegal in that regard?
Well, Senegal was actually one of the centers of the slave trade. So there's an island just off the coast of Senegal, which was a slave trade center. So it's now become a museum where they show all the different types of treatments and the living of the slaves and their masters. So they have what was their warehouse at that time for these slaves. So that is one of the things Senegal is well known for, that this was the center of the slave trade. And of course there are different responses to this issue, a different opinion. I think generally in a normal Senegalese life today, I don't think they even think about it. But people know that it existed, so people don't necessarily think about it. Recently, there was talk about some opinions about reparation and things like that, but. The Senegalese president was one of the African presidents who was not in favor of that. So, but I don't think that that was the official Senegalese position.
Well, it was the official. It wasn't necessarily the popular position.
Yeah. It, well, the president came out that way, but there were many the people who differed from his opinion.
I heard your question differently. I think you want to know even before that.
Yeah, how highly developed a civilization was it?
Before
highly literate
slavery.
And wealthy, fairly wealthy civilizations, I've heard.
You know, what I know of the history prior to that is more focused around the different Muslim leaders who were in that general region prior to the arrival of the Europeans. I don't know so much about the actual, you know, what was happening. There were peoples on the coast who were fishermen. There were people inland who were already, I think, already had some animals. But I don't know as far as, you know, did they have language, a written language or something like that. I don't believe so, but I wouldn't swear by it either.
No, I don't really think there was a written language at that point, but that because of the spread of Islam, that there was this build-up of kingdoms, you know, around the powerful Islamic leaders and kings, and they had a lot of trade between the Africans around that area and those on the other side of the Sahara. So there was trans-Sahara trade already going on. So people probably were rich, they had stuff, but I don't think that it was actually a written language. But if you go towards Cameroon, there was a king, one of the kings who actually developed his own language. And it was used before Islam.
So that's an area that I think not enough people know anything about, including us. So, yeah.
What's the average diet like there?
Depends on the time of year. I'm afraid right now it was a really bad year for rain last year. 2002 in January had unseasonal rains, 3 days of rain and 50 degree temperatures, which in our area nobody had ever experienced before. And it killed hundreds of thousands of animals. And it was a time of year when there's normally not a drop of rain. So then when rainy season came around, which normally starts in July or August, there wasn't enough rain. It's like we got last year's average rainfall, but we got it all in January, which was not planting season, nor was it a time when grass was going to grow. So the rainy season last year was really poor. There were bad harvests. There wasn't pasture, grass for the animals. So when we left Lingaren at the, like, May 2nd or something, we already knew of places where people were down to one meal a day, eating rice, probably with a little bit of dried fish. Maybe they have a goat around that's still given a little bit of milk, so they'll get a little bit of milk. One of the glorious things, just a little sarcasm there, that the French did was say, okay, peanuts are a really good crop to grow, so quit growing millet and start growing peanuts. And it's a cash crop, and millet had been the staple. So they did. They started growing peanuts, and now the price of peanuts on the world market has dropped. They're trying now, of course, to privatize everything. So people are, at the time when they quit growing millet to feed themselves, they started importing rice. So rice is now the main staple. There are still a few places where people grow a little bit of millet, but not near enough. So, and that too, this year there just wasn't nearly enough millet. Because of the privatization, I'm a little bit optimistic that maybe people will start to grow more millet, and that will come back into the diet. But you always need rain too, so.
So, but typically before that, before the French introduced the groundnut and went to eating rice, a typical poor person's meal would be millet and milk, and they can cook it in different ways. So which was a meal that was much richer than the rice.
And when there are leaves or greens, they'll also prepare greens and eat that with millet. And if there are peanuts, then they'll also cook a sauce that's sort of a peanut-based sauce. So
the staple
but the tradition
is rice
is
and
rice.
Fish.
And if you ask a Senegalese what is the typical Senegalese meal, in Senegal they'll say it's chebujin. And cheb is the word for rice and jin is the word for fish. That would typically mean a really tasty dish of rice that's cooked in, it's steamed a bit and then it's cooked in a tomatoey broth. And it's served with fish and vegetables which have also been cooked in this tomatoey broth, and it's really good stuff. But you know, fresh fish is only in the towns or on the coast. So, yeah.
I think of rice as grown in lots of water. Where does it come from?
Where do they grow rice in the world?
It's imported.
It's imported.
Thailand. Yeah. So it's imported. There is an area in southern Senegal called the Casamance where there has been rice production for a long time. I don't dare guess how long. But it's not nearly enough for the needs of the whole country. And they've also dammed the river which makes the northern border between Senegal and Mauritania, which will disturb again the traditional cultures and how they used to plant millet as the flooding receded. But the goal is to irrigate and to be able to grow rice. So, yeah. It's great development, isn't it? It's all so good and progressive. And there must be a couple more goofy questions, and then.
I see some beautiful fabric. Is that a local industry there, or a local craft?
Yeah, fabric is, I think there's also cotton in the southern part of the country, and I wonder if they don't even maybe import some from Mali or some of the neighboring countries. And they produce a lot of fabric. The Senegalese love to dress well, so they wear locally produced fabrics. They also import a lot of fabric for their fancy outfits. Like that glittery thing is certainly an imported fabric. This outfit is made certainly from an imported fabric. So.
But this one is made in Dakar.
Yeah, this fabric is probably a damask cotton that's been made in Dakar. So, yeah. But we need some goofy questions too, you guys. These are all just so serious.
Well, I want to know, you live in Liguerre.
Yeah.
And you work in the villages. How far do you have to go to work? How far are the villages from the town?
Well, when I do go out, how far is the furthest one? I don't know. I don't necessarily know in mileage, but the furthest one maybe takes like an hour to get to on sandy trails through the countryside. Yeah, in a Toyota double cab SUV. No, it's a pickup. Are pickups considered SUVs?
No. But the village is like 8 kilometers away.
Yeah,
kilometers.
The ones that I know. Not the ones that I typically work in.
So you work, you live in Liguerre. Now, you live in a neighborhood? Or is it, what are your homes like? Or?
A hut? There isn't a picture here, is it? It wouldn't be called a hut.
It's called
a house.
Made out of cinder block or wood?
Cement block. Which is probably the most common construction material now.
Running water and sewage?
Running water, sewage.
And water comes
septic
from?
Septic tank. Water comes from the water company. I mean, where else does water come from?
The pump at the end of the road.
Wells?
Yeah.
Bobo Wells.
Yeah. We have electricity, we have phone, we have a computer, we have cell phones.
Mm. How many rooms?
Three rooms. So there's plenty of room for guests. So people who were there before had three kids.
Wow.
So we don't have any, so we have a lot of space.
You could.
Are you cursed with oil or gold or diamonds so that the multinationals are going to exploit you somehow?
Or, yeah, right.
So far we're cursed with fish and
milk.
Milk, yeah, actually milk is one of them, but we don't have them. We can produce enough milk in the country, but we are overpowered by imported milk. That's the way we're cursed here.
Yeah.
So we have phosphate too.
And there is gold.
There's gold.
I even ripped out an article that I saw because it was, I hadn't really heard about it before, but there is an area where I guess there's some, how do we say it in English? Artisanal gold mining. Do we say that in English?
No.
We speak pretty funny English sometimes. It's what we say in French.
Artisanal mining.
It's like Montana in the 1850s or something, you know? So there's a bit, and we don't know what that's going to do. And as far as oil, there might be some offshore.
They are thinking about starting to explore that area for oil.
Because there offshore. Has been some found offshore of Mauritania.
So,
yeah. Well, we're cursed by multinationals in other ways.
Is a Senegalese family's wealth dependent on cattle? Is that their...
In the Pula tradition, not Senegalese in general. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And is there, when there's a wedding to come, is there a dowry? And what would that consist of?
I think there is a dowry, but I don't. It is not as, it's not like in other cultures where you have to give 10, 20, or a number of cows. But I think the families negotiate and they give something rather than that. I don't know exactly.
And oftentimes money is involved.
Yeah.
So the other thing that family wealth is dependent on now is who in the family is working overseas.
Uh-huh.
And sending back money.
Yeah.
So that's really become more and more important, and that's why you find more and more young people who their only goal is to find a way to get overseas so they can get any kind of job so that they can send money back to their family.
Is there a particular place to go?
Well,
anywhere
Spain,
where they're
Italy,
thinking.
France
okay.
are probably the hot spots, and the United States. I mean, we constantly have people wondering, how can I get my son into the U.S.? How can I get to the U.S.? Can't you help me? So, but we have a hard enough time getting Willie into the U.S. Oh, yeah, he's, because we live overseas, so he has not applied to immigrate to the United States. He has no intention to immigrate to the U.S., especially because of what they put you through even when you don't want to immigrate.
We heard about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Willie, how did you become a Christian? Were you raised that way, or how did you?
I am third generation Christian in my family.
Okay.
Not all of my father's siblings were baptized. What there was, my father was baptized and some of his brothers were baptized, some were not. Actually, one of them became a Muslim. But what the story goes is that my grandfather was captured as a slave and taken to the coast to be put on a ship and taken to wherever the slaves were taken. And somehow he managed to escape in the night. And by foot, he finally got back home about a year later, because it's a very long distance.
Mm.
And so when the Christians came, he saw these faces again that had taken him on
He's had white faces.
He's had those white faces again. And he didn't want it to have anything to do with them. So he refused completely to be baptized. Although his kids were baptized and some they tried to convince him to get baptized and he refused until he was on his dying bed and he wouldn't die for several days. He would go into a coma and come back and go into a coma and come back. And then they told him, you are not dying because you are refusing to be baptized. So if you accept to be baptized, you will die. And so he didn't want to leave because he was already too old. And he didn't want to continue to go into this problem. So he accepted to be baptized. And he died after he was baptized. So, but my two of my uncles refused to be baptized. One of them died, was actually a traditional doctor. He was a very good herbalist. And he took from his father. He died when I was still a kid. And the other one who became a Muslim died last year. Mm-hmm. No, this year.
Just
sorry.
A few months ago.
Just a few months ago.
We better respect the time. We're here. We're not going anywhere. So if you have more questions, let us know. But thanks a lot. We're glad to have you.